If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Consequence Podcast Network.
You know a hit when you hear it, but where did that hit come from? Where did this band come from? Who's the person that digs through the TikToks, the dive bars, the Spotify playlists day after day after day in search of the next great artist? Well, it's the A&R guy, artist and repertoire. So today, our guest is Mike Daly, the head of A&R for Hollywood Records, walking us through how to make a hit. How to make a hit, part one on the What Podcast today. It starts right now. Voted most amazing podcast in the history of mankind. This is the What Podcast. Barry Corder, Brad Steiner, Lord Taco along the way throughout today. Oh, by the way, if you're a first-time listener, thanks for joining us. If you've been around forever, welcome back. So today, a very special day, Barry Corder. We get to finally pull the curtain back on some of the industry that we've never talked about before on the What Podcast, which bands this year that matter.
Yeah, and that vote was unanimous, too, by the way.
Which was the vote?
Best podcast ever.
Yeah, by the way, what was the overall, you know, percentage?
Percentage,
you know, for was 100%.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Actual numbers.
Yeah, do we have, you know, breakdowns by district?
We can get them, but they're 100%. Okay.
Did we win the Electoral College as well?
We won the Electoral, the recount, all of them.
And, oh, wow.
Like, with several judges sided, it was a sweep.
Well, I still think it's fake.
Of course it is.
I still think whatever you're saying is not real. Because if courts say it, if judges say it, doesn't matter. So, by the way, let's step back for a second. If you are new to the show, I would implore you to go back and listen to the Grace Potter interview that we did last week. I loved this. And I very rarely, Barry, you know this, I very rarely even know that the show exists after we do it.
Yeah, right.
I don't go back and listen. When things are done in my life, they're done. Like, I just
that
don't
way with stories. I've never reread a story. Once I hit send to the editor, it's yours and I don't want to see it again ever.
Even the ones you've written about me?
Those I've reread only because you keep sending them to me.
That would be something pretty special. I send your own articles back to you.
Yeah, with made up names. This is the greatest article you've ever written.
Brad's oh man, what if I just start sending you articles to you that were yours in quotation marks? Oh yeah, I remember this article. Remember this? You called me a son of a bitch. So I went back and I actually listened to the Grace Potter chat. And it's not because, you know, I thought it was just such a good episode. She's just phenomenal on every level. She's just a great person. Yep. She's just a good human. And I like listening to her. I feel like we could hang out.
Yep.
You know, I kind of want to hang out with her in her Vermont home. I just kind of want to show up and be like, hey, I'm here, Grace. And she would welcome you with open arms and do whatever you want to.
Because she would have been making cookies. Or something, you know.
She would have been making cookies.
You're just in time.
Yeah.
You know, I've told you, I've had like three or four interviews like that. Warren Haynes, Derek Trucks, and Susan Tedeschi. I've talked to all three of them several times. And the last time I talked to all of them Derek in particular, and I'm terrible name dropping. I get it. I know that. But I call, he answered, and I was like, I have to say, you three are the nicest people that I've interviewed over the years. I said, it always feels like I'm interrupting you doing the laundry or the dishes.
Right.
And he said, that's exactly what I'm doing.
It's what he was doing. Yeah.
That's what well, when just, I was, you know.
Well, when I interviewed Prince. So
yeah, that was, he was doing the dishes.
He's doing the dishes. Sure. You know, but you make a good point, because I think about this a lot. There's just some people that would be really, really, really good grandparents.
Yeah.
And I know that that sounds weird to say about a woman who's, you know, got a, you know, newborn baby. But she's going to be a great grandma.
It means a lot to me. It sounds so trite and Southern and whatever. Mm-hmm. But when people say he's a good guy, it means a lot. I don't say that. I don't throw that out there.
Like Barry, you would be a great grandfather. You're going to be a great grandfather. You're going to be a great granddad. You're going to be a fun grandpop. Yeah. Are you grandpop or are you poppy? Are you pop?
Grandpa Barry.
Grandpa Barry.
Oh, Grandpa Barry.
But can the kids actually get Barry out of their mouth, or they just call you Grandpa Bear?
Grandpa Barry. So, yeah, Grandpa Bear? The older ones. The younger ones, they don't call me anything yet. Get out of the way.
Wait, how old are the older ones?
35.
9. We have. Okay. We will have 7. Here in a little while.
You will have 7 grandkids
in August when Grace has hers. God. We will have 7. Yes.
Oh my God.
I know. I said that the other day. I mentioned that, by the way, during our weekend trip down with the little mini Roo. And I was like, you know, when you say that out loud, it becomes real and it's pretty frightening. It's pretty weird.
I mean, 7 is a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have 7 friends.
That's true. What is it I've always said? You have 2. One is you and the other is fluid.
Thank you. That's me, Brad Steiner. Nice to meet you, LLC.
Say one thing though? I'm glad you brought up going back. And I want to make this correction, because I think what we brag on ourselves is about, you know, about getting things right. But I saw a post on Facebook from Mike Andy about our show with about the Deftones, and he was very, very nice, and but kind of took me really to task for making light of Around the Fur. And calling it a juvenile title, and you know,
stop it. I haven't caught up on any of this. No, there's what podcast drama? Well, have we created drama?
No, he was just super nice. But I wanted to make the correction and say I saw your post, and I admit it. As I said on the show, I did not know Deftones, so I tried to make a joke. You know, that Around the Fur sounded to me like something Van Halen would do with OU812 or. If you know, if you see K, and turns out the song, the title is it's a whole juxtaposition thing about the fur industry and meat and all that. So I just wanted to admit I was wrong.
Barry, yeah. Barry, don't do that.
I know you'd say that.
If it was a joke, it was a joke. Who cares?
And I just want to say we read this stuff, and you know, sometimes you make a joke and get it wrong. I got it wrong. Well, so,
but the whole point of the joke is that you don't need to get it right. It's just a joke.
Yeah, I know.
You were making light about a funny title. Who cares if it? Stop it. Yeah. I've been doing this for 21 years, and the amount of people who have gotten a little bit sideways because of a joke, I can't even. The list is just monumental, yeah, and I'm not even gonna like. You just don't. You just move on and say what it was, and who cares?
Enough. Fair enough. Oh, I agree. I just wanted to.
We can't take things so seriously, guys. We can't take things so seriously.
Ah, all right. So, excited about this show.
But do you feel better? Do you feel better now?
I feel better.
Okay, good. Well, that's all that matters. See, this is why Barry is a good person, and I am not.
Fair enough.
I would be a terrible grandfather. I'd be a terrible papa.
Yeah. Yeah. Let it go. It's funny.
Yeah. The no, it is, you know, hey kid, I punch you in the face. Look at that. It's funny, right?
Get up, it's funny.
Get up, it's funny. So I had this idea when we first started expanding the podcast, you know, from the Bonnaroo world last year before the COVID thing hit, because it's something we never really talked about, and we love talking about parts of this industry that we don't really know. And it all started, if you're new to the show, it all started one day when Barry and I were walking backstage at Bonnaroo, And Bonnaroo is in the middle of a field in Tennessee. There's no electricity. They have to create an entire city, which becomes the sixth biggest city in the state of Tennessee every single year. They have to create it every time. They've got to whip it up like a tornado and drop it in the middle of a field in Tennessee. So
literally a 700-acre farm.
So we were walking backstage one day, and we're walking along the road, and I look down to the ground, and there are wires all the way down the road. And then eventually the wires get into PVC pipe. And then the more we were walking, the PVC just continued down the road. And it hit me at that moment. And I know this sounds so trite, but it hit me. Oh my God, they have to put down wires to run this thing. Who did that? Who put those wires down? Who laid the PVC pipe? Who, you know, that there must be a million yards of just electric wire.
And why'd they put it there, not over there? And
And so that's when it started hitting us, like, oh my God, there's an entire industry that nobody seems to really talk about. And it's those guys, it's that kind of thing that we really, really enjoy. And I know it's nerdy, and I hope that you like it too. Some of you do, some of you don't. Some of you just want to listen and talk about bands and talk about, you know, stage placement. That's cool too. But this kind of stuff, I really, really nerd out about. Maybe it's because of my industry. Maybe it's just because of, you know, I obsess over tiny minutia and details like that. But either way, this was an idea that I had that I wanted to bring to the team and say, hey, how do you make a hit? Do you know how you get the bands on the festival lineup? Not just a guy who's plucked them out of a live show and seen a live show and decides to put them on. No, there's a whole industry here of getting that artist on a stage that also requires marketing, getting a radio hit, and before that, getting found to begin with. Who finds the band? Who establishes a career, who creates the hit, who then delivers the hit to the radio station, who delivers the marketing plan, who delivers the booking of the tour, on and on and on. So we've talked to booking agents before. That's a great episode if you want to get a little masterclass on how a tour is put together, especially a tour inside COVID. But today we're going to start a two-part series on how you get a hit. How do you make a hit and who makes the hit? So next week, we're going to talk to one of the most brilliant radio people in all the country. And I don't say that because the guy is my boss. He literally, I thought this about him before we started working together a year ago. And I'll think about it till the day I die. The guy just knows radio and knows he's just got the best ear in the country. His name's Troy Hansen. This week, though, we start from the granular level of where a band gets found. Yep. And then when that band gets found, how does that mature into an actual living, breathing entity that can find its way onto a festival lineup. Yeah. So today, the head of A&R for Hollywood Records, Mike Daly, is our guest on how to make a hit, part one, Barry Corder.
Do I get to talk?
I would love for you to talk if you'd like to.
I wasn't sure you were going to take a breath.
It's so weird. That was originally the name of the show.
Brad takes a breath.
Do I get to talk?
No, what I love about this, as you were talking, I was thinking most people get to see things from the top down. You read about the bands that made it. You know what I mean? They only make documentaries about the bands that made it and films and books and all that. So you get to go back in time a lot in a lot of cases, and they say, you know, we got discovered 20 years ago, whatever.
Sure.
What you and I, and you talk about this a little bit with Mike, and you've mentioned it with some other bands, you know, they come knocking on your door and want to play out in your little courtyard at your former radio station, or their PR person sends me a press kit and I either choose to open it or not. So we have that unusual advantage of maybe sort of following bands from small to big. Most people don't really, number one. And number two, the question of why this band and not that band, you know what I
right.
mean? How many talented bands out there for whatever reason didn't make it? And to hear Mike talk about, and there are other examples, but to hear him go to a show in an airport hangar to hear almost Monday when they were basically saying, please don't come to this show because we know it's not going to be good.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I'm going. And, you know, he's talented enough and experienced enough to realize the circumstances and to see that they had talent.
Yeah.
You know, that to me is the standout moment that we're about to hear. But those.
Yeah. And you brought it full circle. The band that he, that at least where I found Mike was when we interviewed Mike Almost Monday, and Almost Monday brought him up as being the guy that found them and gave them their shot. And it was that story that they told in an episode a few weeks ago about how he came to this airport hangar and a show that they didn't want him to come to. And he mentioned that in the thing. Now, the hard part about A&R is that, and I say this in the thing, and I try to lead him down this path, but it is the hardest job in all of the industry. The pressure on these people is unlike anything that you have ever experienced. They have to deliver hits. And if they don't deliver hits, if you don't have a history of making hits, you don't get a job. If you can't find the next thing, if you are just the slightest bit behind the next A&R guy, you're yesterday's news. It is a pressure cooker. And, you know, for a guy like me who fancies himself having a good ear and, you know, dreams of being an A&R guy one day, I could never do that job. I could never. You have to have a level of not just work ethic, but desire to beat everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That yeah. I don't think I have it.
It's fascinating.
It's a special group.
Fascinating to hear him describe what he does.
Yeah. So, and I bring up the pressure part of it mainly because if you're watching this on YouTube, the man's sitting in front of an azalea plant. Yeah. I mean, he's just by his pool, you know.
I love that.
He doesn't seem pressured whatsoever.
I love that when you bring that up because you don't know if he turns that camera even just a little bit what we're looking at, you know.
Oh, my God.
Parking lot.
It could be a Dollar General, or it could be, you know, $1 million pool. Yeah, who knows?
It could be his station wagon full of clothing or whatever.
With that being said, you know, they have a very hard job, but they make a lot of money. They make a lot of money.
The good ones, I imagine. That was the other thing I love, and you'll see. Well, we can. I just love the confidence that he has in his abilities. I mean, he didn't say that, but you can hear it in what he says. He knows.
Boy, if you don't have it, you better fake it, dude.
Yeah.
If you don't have it, you better fake it because they will see right through you. You'll get eaten up and chewed up and eaten alive in a heartbeat if you don't got it right.
Yeah, it's great. It's good. Right. Another good interview.
So this is Mike Daly from Hollywood Records on the What Podcast? Which Bands This Year of That Matter? Which, by the way, what you're hearing in 2 seconds, the sweet, sweet study beats of Midist. Our friend Nick Turner and his band Midist have graciously given some of their brilliant work to us as interludes, if you will, getting us in and out of places in the show. So here you go. This is Midist and then Mike Daly from Hollywood Records on the What Podcast.
Good, man.
I'm so happy that you're here because this is a topic that I've been trying to talk to people like you about forever. I'm obsessed with what you do for a living. I'm obsessed with what it is that the things that you can physically do and control. I one time annoyed Sam Ryback from Interscope so much over dinner that he eventually just had to get up and leave because I just couldn't stop talking about this. All right, so
this happens a lot more than you might think, Mike.
It actually does. Yeah, it actually has nothing to do with it. It's me. It's not the topic.
Man, you must be going deep. Sam is such a mellow, awesome dude. I know,
he's
Sam.
Really awesome. I'm a big, big fan. So. I want to start the conversation I want to have with you is so vast, but sure. I want to start from the beginning. How in the world did you get to where you are today? Where did it begin? Just the quick 30,000 foot view, so we can lay a foundation as to what all this thing is.
I'll bullet point it for you.
Sure.
So, like, you know, like every other 16-year-old kid, I just wanted to be like the next guitar god. And then I went to Berkeley and Boston for college. Somehow I talked my parents into that. And then after that, I was in a very not good indie rock band signed to Bar None Records out of Hoboken in the Wayback Machine.
What was the name of the band?
That band was called Swales, S-W-A-L-E-S. I think we did one record. We tried really hard and it really went nowhere. And then I started just doing sessions and playing for people around New York. And I was playing with Edith Frost, who was on Drag City Records, a singer, songwriter girl, totally awesome. And funny enough, we did this tour and she moved to Chicago, and in her band was Glenn Cochee, who went on to be in Wilco. And then after I got home from the Edith Frost tour was when I joined Whiskey Town, and then did that till, you know, the wheels eventually came off. And ironically, at one point, Glenn had just started playing with Jeff, and we were trying to get Glenn to join Whiskey Town. And thank God for Glenn's career, he didn't, and stayed with Jeff and Wilco. And then after that, I was playing sessions and writing, producing around New York. Did a ton of stuff. I moved out here to LA and I did a bunch of records for Hollywood Records, like Grace Potter and this great guy, Patrick Park. It never worked out, but he was amazing. And then through my writing, producing, I've worked with like Lana Del Rey and Imagine Dragons and Jason Mraz and tons of different people. And then about 8 years ago, I think it was, Ken Bunt was taking over for Bob Cavallo. And he pitched me on this A&R idea. And, you know, I still write and produce outside of the label. And I had always wanted the insight of how things work inside labels, because I had developed bands and got them deals, and then it would all sort of fall apart. And I didn't really understand. So I felt like it'd be a good way to learn more. So I took the gig and I've really enjoyed it, you know?
Okay. So the reason why I love this topic so much, and essentially it's how to make a hit. And, you know, when somebody like, so honest, first off, I want to warn you that there's going to be a lot of dumb questions. because you have almost like a Wizard of Oz sort of job, in that people may know it exists, but they don't know what happens behind the curtain. They have no idea
meaning there's nothing behind the curtain.
Well, there may not be.
I think that's a great intro. I keep hearing the Tom Petty song. My A&R guy says I don't hear a single. Number one is one thought that I have, and the other is when you were talking, and it's so great that you're a producer songwriter because you come at it from that way. But from my perspective, 30 something years, it always seems like a band that's about to make it, it's the A&R guy that somehow screws it up. But what I mean by that is the A&R guy finds them, loves them, you know, he's all in, and then he either moves up, moves on, changes jobs or whatever, and the band is left sort of hanging. Is that even close to fair? I mean, that's what it seems like.
I mean, it's hard to say, and I think it's changes over time, right? Your A&R guy needs to be, our A&R guy was Mark Williams, who, you know, was on, you know, was over at Interscope then and Columbia and is a Concord now, and I still talk to Mark all the time. Your A&R guy has to be your white knight inside the building, right? And when you lose that white knight, unless you're a massive band, it's really hard. It's really, 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 really hard, because you need somebody inspiring the troops inside the building all the time. And the manager can't do it in the same way. So it's a, and you're also, you know, when you're the A&R person, you're sort of by default always in a sticky situation, right? Because you're asked by other departments to ask the artist to do things that may be related to, I don't know, marketing or whatever, that maybe they don't want to do, or it hasn't been fully explained to them why they should do it. So it's always like, well, you talk to the band all the time, or the artist, like, you talk to them about it. And it's like, I'd really prefer you develop a relationship with them. But okay. So you're sort of always, you're just always in an awkward position. You know, I have a very, I have a few like ground rules with everybody I sign. The first one is like, I will always tell you the truth, no matter if you want to hear it or not. The second one, I'm not your dad. So if you keep asking me the same question, you are definitely not going to wear me down. You will only get the same answer over and over and over again. And number three, the day that I'm working harder on your career than you are is the day I drop you. And
okay. Yeah. That's a great place to start. What is an A&R guy? Or woman?
I mean,
A&R guy or gal?
Yeah, I will say some of the best A&R people working in the business are women, by far. I would actually say, I think women have higher emotional intelligence in general, and I think they are generally less reactive, and I think make better A&R people, just
interesting
as a blanket statement.
Interesting.
Having said that, you know, I look at my job as finding the talent, helping them in whatever it is, right? It can be connecting them with writers and producers. It can be making sure that they don't work with outside writers and producers as to not dilute what it is. It's, you know, some of them need praise. Some of them need, you know, carrots and sticks. And you have to learn what each person responds to, and you have to really try to get into their world and understand how they see the world and what their perception of things are. So that's what you're sort of doing for them. And then inside the building, you are the cheerleader, the therapist, you're whatever needs to be. I think of it as almost like being a manager who has deep musical knowledge and is also inside the building.
And does the A&R guy need to come from a producing / musician background? Do you think that it helps? No?
I don't think they need to be. For me, it's an advantage, because when things aren't right, I can really talk to producers and say, like, there's too much 12K on the kick drum. It's messing up the enunciation of the vocal in this spot. Like, I can really, like, get in, and we can just like fix shit. Like, I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to curse or not.
I think we're gonna be okay.
Okay, we can go in there and fix it in a way that's beyond like, well, I don't know, it's just not getting there. Because, you know, when I was full time writing and producing, I would get notes back like, I don't know, man, just, you know, need some more of the sauce. It's like, I don't know
what that means.
I can't translate sauce into Pro Tools in Ableton, but thank you.
There's not a filter for sauce.
Yeah, I don't really, like, where is my sauce plugin? So I think that it helps in the communication, and I think that sometimes when you're trying to crack a code on a song, you know, a lot of the artists that I write with too are more like, I worked a bunch on the first Young to Giant record, like writing with those guys, and not that they need an outside writer, but it was more like being like the designated hitter and like, well, you know, you can go here in your bridge, or maybe you should talk about this, or maybe, like, it was sort of like I was giving them options.
But are they asking for, are they asking for that feedback, or are you throwing it in because it's your job?
Generally the people I work with ask for it.
Okay.
I don't ever impose my writer producerness on artists. Unless they ask for it, or their co-writer comes to me, who, you know, I know everybody in the writing community here are like, man, what do you think? And it's like, and I'm honest, like, hey, your pre-chorus is too long, or you actually do need a bridge, or lyric is a little boring in the second verse. Like, my job has helped them to get in there, get it better. So if I'm not involved in the actual writing of it, it's like, here are my general things. Like I said, bridge is too long, like whatever. If they're asking me specifically, can you come into the studio with us and really dig in and work on it? Then I will, and it's different. Then it's more like, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this.
Well, maybe this gets to one of the dumb questions, Brad, but along those same lines, the dumb questions Brad alluded to, if there's a meeting around a table, mm-hmm. where are you? Where is the A&R guy? Are you leading the meeting? Are you, you know what I mean? There's a manager, yeah. there's a booking agent, there's a producer, there's the label head. In the pecking order around the table, where's the A&R guy?
Well, everything is downstream from the music, right? I mean, without great music, everything else is just, you know, empty suits Fine. Sitting around a table.
Swimming
You know
upstream.
What I mean?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So to me, and, you know, I know a lot of people sign by data. We're not really a market share label. So we look at data, but, you know, I'm not trying to sign every kid on TikTok that gets a little bit of a buzz. In fact, I mean, in the example of Almost Monday, it was like the anti-data stuff. But back to your question, as far as sitting around the table, it just depends on what the conversation is, right? If the conversation is about trying to get the music right for the album, like you're at the head of the table with the artist. And look, I tell all artists, like, I will be honest with you. If there's a song that you love and I hate, it's your record. You can put your song on there. I don't care. At the same time, if there's a song that's going to change your career and 100x your business and get you to stay in this 10 more years, like, I'm going to be very clear that you are making a very grave mistake.
Okay. So when you become, by the way, artist or repertoire, you become an A&R guy, and then you have to then producing artists that are making hits and making money. So if you're not using a TikTok model, where are A&R people, aside from TikTok and the internet, where are A&R people finding talent these days if they're not going to clubs anymore? Are they still
going
to clubs? Is that still happening? Are you still walking into the 9:30 club and finding somebody?
I love 9:30 club.
Yeah.
Well, not in the last 15 months. That's
yeah, sure.
You know, the thing about the pandemic is the pandemic has been devastating to a lot of people and to the economy, but it is also fast forwarded life. There's things we're doing now, Zooming, telemedicine, remote work, food delivery is now at scale. These are all things that were going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years anyway. Mm-hmm. The pandemic just sped that all up. The adoption rate has gone higher. With that, it is also turbocharged the use of data to find things, right? Whether it be, you know, TikTok or YouTube or wherever. The majority of A&R is being done by internet, social media, streaming, things that are taking off on generally Spotify a bit more than the others because you can just see the play counts. Mm-hmm. But it's more people digging into that kind of data, but still a lot of the traditional things, lawyers, managers, more managers. I think the lawyers are, there's so many deals happening right now that I think lawyers probably are too busy to actually shop deals.
Interesting. Lawyers shop deals.
Yeah. But it's more more managers and internet and probably shows again when it starts back up. Okay. But I don't know anybody who is like, yeah, I'm just going to roll down to the Troubadour tonight and see who's playing. Like that, that's your check. I mean, even if you're going to like school night or some of the other LA sort of new artist shows, like you're definitely checking everybody out online beforehand.
What has your year been? I mean, are you focused on keeping the clients you have happy or finding new? Or, I mean, has it changed in that regard? I assume you're always looking for, you know, the next. What's the last year been like?
Well, a lot of Zoom meetings, always looking for the next, obviously. Trying to keep artists and bands engaged and creative and trying to frame it as an opportunity. And I think that I've been lucky that a lot of my acts have seen it as an opportunity of like, wow, I don't have to go out and play every weekend. I can really focus on my craft of writing. And, you know, a lot of people did a lot of live streams. And I think that live streams will stay, but I think that's going to morph into more of the metaverse world down, you know, the sort of that world of lives. I think that's where live streaming goes. So it's been a lot of that. And it's been, honestly, it's been a lot of just talking to people and lowering their anxiety about things.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you have a lot of artists who hit a wall when it, like, and all the stuff lined up and then it all went away.
Right.
Yeah. So you have, you find somebody like Almost Monday, who we talked to a couple weeks ago. Mm. You find somebody like Almost Monday, even if it's a data-driven thing, not a data-driven thing. And then when you go to sign them, you're not going to be the only person trying to sign them. What is the competition like? And how do you break through to get the artist that you want to sign with you?
Okay, so I'll give you two scenarios, right? So Almost Monday, I was the only one trying to sign them. And my biggest fear was somebody was going to find out about them. I found Almost Monday because their mixer and co-producer's manager, Andrew Brightman, who's a good friend of mine, said, hey, I got this band. I think you're going to like it. And he sent me three songs. And I thought they were fantastic. And I said, I got to see this live. Like, when are they playing in? I got to see this live. He said, well, they have this one show, but don't come because it's not a real show. Blah, 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 blah. And I was like, okay, cool. I will definitely be there. And he's like, no, you really, you know. And I was like, no, it's cool. I will, I've played these shows. I know what I'm walking into. So it was Memorial Day. It was Memorial Day a year and a half ago or so. And it was at the Santa Monica airport hangar. And it was a high school girl throwing a music and art show. Every person there, the median age was maybe 15. And me and my buddy rolled up. They were playing in a room. There was no PA. Mark Needham was there and had like a mini mixer in his trunk that he broke out. And I met the band before for a couple minutes. I'm like, cool guys, like whatever. Then I was out, like, I think they had a taco truck there or something, getting a taco. I tried to go back in to see the band and a 15-year-old kid was like, no, you have to pay. And I was like, no, I paid. I was just in there. He's like, man, you can't be sneaking in. And I was like, dude, do you really think I'm like, I mean, I will pay you again, but do you really think I'm sneaking into this? Which was like, sort of, we all joke about it. And I went in.
That kid's going to be a CEO one day.
Yeah,
that's the
kid I want right there.
Yeah, I know, really. I was like, you want an internship?
Yeah.
After I talked my way past the 15-year-old.
bum rushed the show, did you?
Yeah, I did, man. I did. I went in and the band started playing in this room and it sounded terrible. I mean, it was so abusive to the ears. The songs were so good. And Dawson was like, I felt like I was watching like INXS. His first club gig, he had so much of like that thing on stage, and I was literally taking video of it, and I sent it to the label president, and I was like, I'm signing this band or I'm quitting my job.
Wow.
And Ken was like, calm down. He's like, that kid looks like a star. I'm like, these songs are bangers. I was like, we're gonna do this. So we talked to him afterwards. They had no lawyer. They had no booking agent. Mm-hmm. They had no manager. And they sort of confessed this to me very sheepishly. And I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This is great. So they hooked up through Andrew with Nick Ferrara, who's an amazing attorney. And I think they thought I was going to be bummed out. They didn't have all the infrastructure, but I was like, no, this is great. Like,
no, it's actually better for you that way.
Well, I could just get them the best team in the world. Yeah. And now they have Andy Mendelsohn at Full Stop managing him, who has Kings of Leon and is so great. And Marty Diamond is their booking agent, right? It's like they have a world-class team, because the other thing with any of this is that without the best team around it, it's not going to work. I don't really care how good the music is. If you have a terrible manager, it's not going to work. It's too hard. So that's the arc of all. And 14 days after that show, the deal was signed.
That raises a whole nother, it's another thing that I've run into many, many times, is if there's more than two people in a band, it's complicated, right? Then you start adding in girlfriends and wives and managers, and the bass player wants to be huge, but the drummer doesn't. How much of that do you have to, a rude word for it, but fix is what I'm unscrew, I guess, is what, how often does that happen where you've got a great talented band, but something is just broken, you know, whether it's like you said, manager or a girlfriend or misguided expectations one way, you know, from one or the other.
Well, I think that going into it, I have a lot of conversations with people about like, who do you want to be? Like, and you know, Almost Monday from San Diego, I'm like, great. Do you want to be the Kings of San Diego or do you want to be the Kings of the World? Like, Like, exactly. What is your ambition? And like, I live in Silver Lake here, and you know, there's a lot of super cool Silver Lake bands that really just want to be super cool bands. And like, that's awesome. It's not a business I can invest in, because that's just not the business model we're in. So you just have to make sure everything is aligned, and you know, you just have to manage expectations, everybody's expectations all the way down the line. You know, from moment one, you have to manage expectations. And then as far as managers, there's not a whole lot you can do, because you can get, you know, there's torturous interference laws. And so you hope that they don't have a bad manager. The girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever thing, you know, those sort of seem to work themselves out, because generally the other people in the band will finally throw down and solve that. But I'm pretty honest with people, and I've, you know, you can ask anybody who I've A&R'd, that I will tell them generally, like, you're making a mistake, and I know why you don't see it as a mistake, but you are making a mistake.
I assume with your experience, can you identify those problem bands pretty quickly? Are there cases where you thought you had a great one and boy, I didn't see that coming? Or can you identify it pretty quickly? Like, this band, there's a problem here and it's either going to have to be fixed or I'm walking, type of thing.
They say that love is blind. I tend to think talent is blinding. So it is very hard sometimes to see reality when that's not the reality you want to see. And I think that that's a symptom of being a human more than anything else. So I just really, really try to look at things through as an unbiased view as I can. Having said that, there was one artist I had at some point, and we had a sit down, and I just said, look, this is what you did previously. This is what your last tour did. And either we need to make some changes, or you should realize that you peaked a year and a half ago. And it's a tough conversation. And half, and it was like a 50-50 split. And I was just like, you guys should go decide what you want to do. It's your lives. You don't have to do this. I would love to keep doing it with you guys, and it's all good, but I don't force anybody to do anything.
And of course, this is all not just, you know, in a money-making opportunity, but this is what they laid out as their goals when they first sat down with you at the beginning and said, this is who I want to be. This is what I want to be. And how do I get there? You know, you talked a lot about the data, or I'll put it this way. You talked about the second verse being, you know, too long, or when you are so after you sign them, after you have gone through the competition, after you get them in the studio and you're starting to craft a song and you're starting to craft a career, what is the most important thing that you try to get them to do? Are you looking for them to write a radio hit? Are you trying to get them to make money? Are you trying to see what song works best with a sync? What are the goals that you sit down to try and flesh out when you make a, you know, when you have the band now in the studio?
I have one goal: quality. That's it. That's all we can control, is how good the music is. Everything else you can influence, but you cannot control it. So to me, I don't really think about, is this a radio song? Is this a sync song? Is this bridge going to blow up on TikTok or anything like that? To me, it's how do we make the art as good as it can be? Because commerce follows art. Art never follows commerce. That's not the way the universe works. And that's the, for me, like, that's it. I mean, it's that simple. Like, yes, it's great when they go like, wow, I played this for the radio staff and they're freaking out. Like, that's amazing. And I also think at some point in people's careers, if you want to put out an album that doesn't have like hit songs or radio songs or whatever, and you've earned it, then go ahead. I mean, you know, there is no Amnesiac without Kid A. Mm-hmm. Like, let's face the facts. Mm-hmm. No Kid A, you don't get to make Amnesiac. Mm-hmm. You know, like, hits and big songs buy you freedom. Mm-hmm. And it's that freaking simple.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Coen brother model, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Put out
a movie that everybody likes, and then I can start making the stuff that I really want to make.
Right. I mean, Steve Buscemi, same way.
Yeah.
How much of your job Mike, and you've kind of said it, but how much of your job is pushing and how much is pulling?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I think it depends on the day. I think it also depends on the context. I generally, going back to my, the day I work harder on your career than you is the day I'm dropping you.
Right.
I will tell people when they're messing up. I will drive to make things as great as they can be. But if I feel like I'm dragging an artist along, then I will tell them, like, I'm no longer doing this because it won't work. Scott Litt, who, I don't know if you know who Scott Litt is, massive producer, produced like Nirvana Unplugged and mixed Walking on Sunshine, actually. But, you know, Scott Litt, when Whiskey Town was signed to Outpost, he was one of the founders at Outpost. I remember him telling me years later, he's like, you can't outwork the artist. I know why you think you can. I know why you think you can catch every falling knife. You cannot work out the artist. The artist is always the tip of the arrow. And if they're not, stop. It will not work. It's not the way it works.
But am I right to assume, though, every artist's version of work is different? You know, some artists are going to work really hard at radio. Some artists are going to be really great workers in the studio. Not, I mean, I had a boss one time tell me that the farm needs thoroughbreds and worker mules. You can't all be thoroughbreds. You can't all be worker mules. So every artist is going to work differently based on, I guess, whatever goal that they have set out to you for, right?
Right. But that is true. But they have to do the hard work in all areas. It's too hard anymore. It's just too hard. You cannot have a career if your songs aren't streaming and you're not going on tour and you're not really working on your craft. Mm. Then you're a hobbyist. Mm. Then this is a hobby.
Along those lines, that's a great question. Mm. And I had a boss said the same thing, Brad. We have, you know, thoroughbreds and mules. How much conversation do you have to have, like with an Almost Monday? I mean, another conversation I've had for many, many years is an artist, a lot of them don't want to do the marketing. They don't want to do the interviews. They don't want to do the not performing parts. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? They just think this is all I'm going to do. But you really have to have the whole package, don't you? I mean, you
do.
And now you got social media and all this other stuff.
Look, nobody's going to want to do everything, and artists shouldn't do everything, you know, and I don't really want artists who are like, I will do anything, right? It's like, you don't really want that either, but you have to figure out why they don't want to do it. If they don't want to do it because they're scared of doing it wrong or scared of looking foolish in their dumb friend's eyes or that stuff, then you have to sort of work through that. But everything is about the why. Right? Like, why don't you want to do it? And if you say, look, I don't want to do that interview with whatever, because I have a deep held philosophical view that is very different than the parent company of that organization. God bless. Cool. Totally get it. If you say, I don't want to meet with the Spotify people because I think it's better for me to be mysterious after a show, then it's like, then you're an idiot. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, you are living out a fantasy that is based on fear. You don't want to meet them because you don't think you're enough and you think they're going to see through you. So let's get to the root of that and let's figure it out. Because if you don't want to do those things, then again, you're a hobbyist. Professionals do the work. Hobbyists only do the play.
So right now in the climate that we're in now, what is the most important thing for a band to accomplish, whether they're new, established, et cetera? What do they need to do to in the next 6 months?
Depending on where they are in their career, I would tweak the answer a little bit, but net overall, get better at your art and everything else follows. Get the songs as great as they can be. Because if you're great at social media, you're great at all this stuff and your music sucks, even if you get it going, it's going to run out of steam. Whereas if the songs are just great and you're consistent, that's another thing you really need these days is just consistency, then you will get somewhere. And then suddenly you'll realize, like, wait, my social media is actually sort of taking care of itself. And I don't really have to tend that garden as much because of the strength of the song. Your song is sort of your first for everything else.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it sort of walks me into a kind of a delicate territory that I know mm-hmm. is sensitive to your side of the industry. So so you get a great song, but uh-huh. you're not judged as an A&R guy just on great songs, right? Uh-huh. At some point, like, what is the judgment
for you, for your boss, for your peers, and how much pressure is there on you to perform at that level every time?
Me personally, we're in a, our label's a little bit different. We have 25 to 30 artists on the label, whereas a lot of the other majors have 125. There is pressure to perform. But at the same time, for me, again, all I can control is how good the art is. I can't control if the marketing department does their job or the streaming department or whoever. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can control. So that's all I really focus on. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, if I look at some things at the label that we've done where we have had big streaming numbers or have had hits with them, you know, it's always been things really of quality. And that's what I just sort of stand on. Yeah. Is that, you know, because otherwise, if you just go, oh, this thing is blowing up and you start chasing stuff that's a hit now, by the time you find something and get it out, it's moved on anyway. Everything moves too fast these days.
Well, that's sort of where I was going. It's like art is so subjective. And mm-hmm, we have, there's so many different opinions about this and that. And it always felt like A&R guys, their one mission was to perform hits, get hit after hit, mm-hmm, after hit, after hit. And if you're not a hit machine, then what happens? I'm just trying to figure out, are we in a world right now where hits are not necessarily as important because there's so many other pathways for an artist to be successful, a DSP, the right sync, a festival shot. You know, there's a different version of success these days than just having, you know, chart success.
Yeah. Well, I think you've gotten to the heart of it, which is what a hit is harder to define now than ever, right? Like somebody has 100 million streams on a song. Is it a hit? I don't know. You like, how do we define a hit? It used to be a lot easier when hits were like, oh yeah, it's on, you know, however many radio stations and it's doing this and that's driving this many CD sales every week, right? But you have songs that are crushing at streaming and aren't on the radio at all. You have other, mm-hmm, songs that are on the radio and are a hit, mm-hmm, I guess.
But you couldn't sell a ticket to their show. But you couldn't sell a ticket to their show.
So yeah. It's so amorphous. I try to look at everything, and I was having a conversation with a friend of mine at Virgin about this the other day, as you know, I also think the day and age of the music superstar is sort of behind us. I don't think you'll ever see the Michael Jackson level, the U2 level of superstar again. I think people's attention is bifurcated in a bajillion different ways now. And I think that you have to look at each of these artists and these acts as like a small business. And how do you grow this small business into a very healthy business? It can't be, if you exist only in black and white, that like this is like a complete smash, like, the numbers are so small when you look at the things signed, the things that come out compared to that. I don't think anybody would have a job anymore. So I tend to look at it, like I think about, like, if you're one of the two guys that founded Google, right? You're super crazy rich, right? But if you're the guy who owns 10 gas stations in San Francisco, you're probably pretty rich too. Are you ever going to be as rich as the Google guy? No. But that doesn't mean you're not rich. So if you have a band that's generating income from themselves, labels getting a return, they have a good touring business, a great sync business or whatever, like that's a viable business. I mean, you can invest in those businesses.
That is an amazing way of putting it. I never thought about it that way, but that's so right.
Yeah, along those lines, Mike, I mean, for you personally, keep going back to, I mean, what you just said and the Coen brothers sort of metrics. For you, I mean, do you have to have that hit so that you can sign 2, 3, 4, you know, that you love that maybe aren't going to have that ginormous hit? Do you have to worry about that? And how much of what you do personally is kind of the what have you done for me lately thing? You know, at what point does it become nervous time for you? I got to find the next thing.
Because I'm always looking for the next thing. I don't think I ever go into the wake up in the 3 a.m. sort of panic, like, oh my God, I got to find the next thing. You know, look, we all want hits. We all want things to work. And I'm always looking. And I'm probably harder on myself than anybody at the label is. So I don't, you know, I feel my own internal pressure much more, I think, than pressure exerted upon me. I will say that the majority of things that I brought in and we didn't get have blown up. A lot of things that we did get either are on their path to becoming big, or maybe we're out of business now, but did really good business in the interim. And yeah, I mean, look, it's a hard job. I mean, it's a really, really difficult, hard job, because you have a lot of the responsibility and not a lot of the control. And I think any job where you have those two crosswinds, it's tough. You know, I mean, it's really tough.
Look, I purport to know not much, but if there's something I do know, it always felt to me like the A&R guy was the hardest job in the entire industry. And that's why I'm so interested in it.
I
appreciate your time. I mean, I really do. This I could literally talk about this all day. I mean, there's
I'm happy to keep going.
I asked this question of Sam one night at dinner, and he absolutely refused to answer me. So I asked him again and again and again. And so I have a feeling I know what your answer is going to be. But
am I going to text Sam this question just to see if he has PTSD? Maybe.
What is there one that was this close that got away that you wanted really, really bad? I'll tell you why you think. The reason why Sam refused to answer that is because he said, because I'm going to sign him one day and I'm not going to tell you who it is.
Oh, wow.
Sam is the best.
Yeah.
Boy, let me think about that. None of them keep me up at night, because I just move on and I wish them well. I'm trying to think of, I mean, I will tell you, I saw Sam Hunt open for Chase Rice in Boston years ago, before he had a deal, before he had anything. He was playing acoustic guitar and singing. He had a guitar player and they're playing to tracks, and the songs are just unbelievable. And we do have a lot of joint ventures in Nashville, our label, but we didn't have the infrastructure to really to do that. So that was one that was like,
love that answer. And I'll tell you why. What year was that? It's got to be 7 years, 8 years.
I don't remember.
The reason I ask is because the reason I love that is because there was something in you that said, based on what was happening in country music, the way that it was crossing over, the way that just some of the guys just looked, right? He had the look, he's got the sound, he's got the songs. And you probably said to yourself, I think that's where country's going.
Well, it was funny. I was there to see Chase Rice, I literally left the venue and called the president of the label. I'm like, okay, so here's the news. I want to sign both of these guys. And I was there to see Chase, because Chase at the time, you know, he was on, John Marks was playing him when he was at the Highway, and it was a rainy Sunday night in Boston, and it was at Paradise, and it was freaking packed. Mm-hmm. And people were singing along to songs that weren't on the radio. It was like, this is real. We didn't get Chase. We just weren't, at the time, we weren't really set up to do that. So it was like I stumbled across Pink Sweats, who I love, before anything. I think I might have actually sent Pink Sweats to Sam, if I don't.
No, Pink Sweats is Atlantic now.
Yeah, but I sent it before it was signed. I sent it to Sam. But like, again, it's not something that our label was set
interesting
up to do.
Interesting. So there's inner dynamic trading happening. There's like other, you send them to somebody else sometimes just because you know it's probably going to work out a little bit better and they've got an infrastructure for it.
Life is too short. Don't we all just want to get good music into the world? And like, I'm not in competition with Atlantic. I'm in competition with Mike Daly every morning that I wake up with.
Let me jump on that, because it's an obvious question, and I think you've probably alluded to some of the answers, but what are the reasons, you just mentioned the one, we weren't prepared for it, but what are the reasons that you wouldn't get an act? I mean, I'm thinking everything from you just personally don't hit it off to they like somebody. I mean, what are the sort of reasons why Mike Daly doesn't get somebody?
Whatever. Well, I can think of a, I can like roll a deck through deals we haven't gotten. you know, for us, the selling part of our label is that there's 25 to 30 artists. So you get time, you get attention. We don't do like one EP, it didn't work, then you sit on the shelf for 3 years or you get dropped or whatever. We don't do that, right? So you get time and you get attention. Our label has as many streaming people, radio people as any other major label. And we're housed inside the world's biggest entertainment company, right? So you get all of these other opportunities that you would never have gotten, right? So that's sort of the sell. Now, I've lost deals because other people have just come in and paid an ungodly amount of money. I've lost deals because managers were one deal was really, really good friends with the president of another label. So they got it. There was another deal we lost because the artist was very good friends with another artist who was on a big label, and they went to the same label as that big artist. Okay. You know, sometimes, those are some of the ones I could think of sort of off the top of my head. I mean, we're not like I said, we have a lot of joint ventures in country. So we have one with Warner's and we have most of them with Universal down there. And we have a couple things with both of them, which is great.
But the other unsaid part of all this is that you work on a budget too. You know, uh-huh. you don't have an endless amount of money. Like, you just can't just like sign everybody and anybody that you want to. You have to be really diligent about the ones that you are putting resources behind.
But let me stop you there. We have to be more diligent because we're not a market share company.
And
right?
Now explain the difference between the two.
Market share, when you're at more of a market share company, and that's any kind of company, right? Like, look at Spotify. Like, I love Spotify. Spotify uses millions upon millions upon millions of dollars a year, right? So does Netflix. They're growth companies, right? For us, we work on money in, money out, right? For some of the other labels, it's all just about increasing market share. So you can lose $1 million on something, but increase market share and it's seen as a win.
Barry, right? Barry, it's a masterclass. I mean,
this is amazing.
I think I'm a little out of my depth on really getting into market share definitions with other labels, but
I got one for you. I'm 18 years old. I'm talented. I want to record. I want to be a star, I think. What are the things that I need to, what are the questions I need to ask a Mike Day who comes to an airport hangar and hears me at a horrible show? What are the things I need to be asking, thinking of to protect myself?
Right.
Let's look at it from that point of view, not your point of view. You know, what are some of the, what are the lies I need to be worried about? What are the truths? What are the, you know, I'm 18 years old. I don't know anything.
What would you have told young Mike Daly when he was in Sweens or whatever the name of the band
Swales.
Was?
Swales. Yeah.
I think you need to ask as many questions as you can, right? I think you need to ask, like, how does the label work? What do the different departments do? I think I would ask everything. Like, how do you see our music? Where do you see us in 3 to 5 years? What do you think the steps to success are?
Because the cliche or whatever is, you know, I'm 18, I'm signing the first piece of paper put in front of me, you know, and if you show me zeros, I'm in. And now we've all heard the horror stories of the artists who've given away their catalogs and all that. Does that still happen today? Like, I know it does.
It happened with Taylor Swift a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Well, that's
I won't wade into the Taylor thing. But
because she will find us and she will eat us alive.
Because she didn't give them away. Because Scott Borchetta invested heavily in her career when she was 16. So, but I won't wade into that one.
Well, I'll give you an example. A buddy of mine is in sort of a promotions business, and he's got a couple mm-hmm. acts that he has helped increase their social media numbers to a large Great. Degree. They go from, so here's this guy, a young artist, very talented, goes from nobody to tens and tens and thousands of social media. And he wants to walk away from my buddy who's helped him. Cause as he says, I'm the one with the talent. You haven't done anything for me. So, but they've had a contract. So it happens all I'm coming at this a different way than my original question, but that's the kind of thing I'm asking is I'm young, you know, all I want to be is a star. Somebody comes at me with a piece of paper and zeros, you know, what's the bet? You answered the question with asking questions, but I'm just wondering, are there top five things, top three things? If you hear this, run, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, I think anybody who says like, it's definitely going to work. Like,
okay, fair enough.
You know, like that's definitely like, oh man. You know, it's like always and never are like the two most dangerous words in the English language. Because somebody who says something always happens is lying to you, and somebody who says something never happens is also lying to you.
Yeah.
Because that's not reality. That's not the human existence or the human experience, rather. So I think anybody who tells you anything is definitely going to work, I'd be scared of. But I don't think, we don't do any of those crappy deals. I'm sure those deals are out there, but I don't really have any exposure to them. And okay, it's like anything else, like get a good entertainment lawyer, you know, like your uncle who's a personal injury lawyer should not be looking at your record deal.
Isn't that one of the things Jeff Becker, who is an entertainment lawyer, if you remember, isn't that what he said is better to have a lawyer at the beginning than later?
Yeah.
I love that.
Spend the few dollars at the front end rather than come see me later.
Well, I mean, what Mike said earlier, you know, the first name that you mentioned, the first person, the first entity you mentioned when you started talking about this was lawyer. I mean, it's the first thing you probably should put, you know, put on your backside immediately. You know, you need somebody at your back. You need somebody that's got you, and a lawyer is probably the best thing. But to the point of all of this, do you think that recording success is dependent as much on record labels these days as it had been in the past?
It's an interesting question.
It's a great question.
Because you have a couple different forces at work here, right? One force is now it's pretty economical to record in your bedroom and make, you know, really good sounding records. And, you know, it used to be, it was so expensive to record that there was so many gatekeepers, there's a lot of barriers to enter, right? So those are gone, which I think is great. I think that it's great that people can express themselves. And I'm a true believer in art. So I think that that's amazing. Conversely now, you know, I heard a statistic the other day, something like 40,000 new songs get uploaded every day to the DSPs, Spotify, Apple, Amazon. It's so much. It's so much music that you need to find a way to stand out amongst that sea, right? And some things just raise their hand and get on some good playlists and whatever. But I think that record labels add a lot of value there. I think record labels are very good at expanding people's worlds, right? Like, I think it's very good at giving them a bigger view, like introducing them to people, connecting dots, just making their world bigger.
Yeah.
And again, it's a little bit of a tricky area because defining success is completely, you know, like I have friends of mine who do it all on their own. They make music for like yoga and meditation, and they make a great living at it, and they do it all on their own. But they don't, you know, they have no ambition to tour the world, and, you know, they love what they do. They make a great living, and that's success to them.
I mean, it goes back to a lesson that the old man would say to every old man, everybody's dad has said to him at some point, you know, that job ain't coming knocking at the door. You know, you got to go out and get a job, and it's not just going to come find you. You know, to get out and actually do something, you probably need to, you know, put yourself out there and do it. It's just because you put a song out doesn't mean the world's just going to come to you. Those things just don't happen very often. I mean, in your experience, you can probably count, you know, on one hand, how many people have truly hit success and a level of major success from recording in your bedroom. Billie Eilish, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe, but what I'm hearing from this entire conversation, Mike, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but it just really depends on what you want, right? I mean, it depends on the
artist and
what they really want. If they want to do yoga soundtracks and be successful at it, then don't put them on the road in a van, you know? If you want to be a star and you don't want to ride in the van, you need to know about that. So that it sounds like that's where the conversation, as you said at the very beginning, has to be two-way. It has to be open and it has to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it's aligning goals, managing expectations.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what it is all the way down the line. It's like, you know, you have an artist and the song's going to radio and they're so psyched. It's like, you should know this might not work.
Mm-hmm. The final thing I got for you, because you've been so generous with your time. I mean, by the way, Barry, he ain't living a tough life. Look at that backyard.
I have perfected this square.
The camera angle. Yeah,
I've really perfected good. The camera angle of my yard over the pandemic.
I keep waiting for the umbrella drink to be delivered.
Yeah. Wow, I should have done. That's a really good idea.
Yeah, the row of bikini clad women behind the camera right now are just drinks. Waiting to deliver him. Mai Tai. So being on your level of an A&R guy is one thing, but there's a whole level of people under you that are signing bands. And these are usually kids. These are usually young, aggressive kids, right? Are you seeing like those are the guys that are, I'll put it this way, to get where you are, you got to put in the work. Do you think that you got to make your chops to get to where you are by hustling on the streets and chasing down that act or that band that could get you to the next level? Is it still that kind of process?
I think it's always at some level that process, something that they're not passionate about, or they don't think that they can really add value to, or whatever. I just think it's too hard.
Yeah. You think it's a harder job than you got?
In a lot of ways, yeah, because you know, with manager, you're always at the, you're at the mercy of the artist. The artist can fire you at any minute.
Yeah,
you know?
And in most cases, you haven't gotten paid yet.
Yeah, I mean, how many management deals end in lawsuits? Like a lot. Mm.
Look, and this is where selfishness comes in. There's never been a time in my life where I've not said to myself, "I would really like to be an A&R guy." I'm not kidding. Like, and then one day I was sitting here in New Orleans and this guy I was watching, I was like, this guy is unbelievable. I love this dude so much. And he walked up afterwards. He's like, "Hey, you want to be our manager?" And I said, "Oh God, no, I never,
no.
never want to do that ever in a million years." It is a daunting world. And, for those who have the guts and the passion to do it, you guys are, there's not many of you, and there's even fewer that do it really, really well. And so all the credit in the world to you, man.
I would say it's gig. All hard, you know, it's all hard. It's hard being a manager. It's hard being an agent. You know, it's hard, you know, being a DJ. It's hard, you know, putting on festival. It's not an easy business, and it's hard being the artist. I mean, that's the other thing that we have to remember. Like, I did it. Like, I spent a lot of my years on tour and it ain't easy, man. So like, we really have to have empathy for all the other moving parts. It ain't easy being the creative director who sent five things through for them to look at for photo shoots and everybody hates everything. It's not easy. I mean, look at videos. I mean, how do you even make a good music video? Like, I feel like almost every video is terrible. And then one is like really good. Like, I don't,
man,
it's
has there really been hard. has there been a great music video since Korn's Freak on a Leash, though? I mean, it really the great music video since Jackson, you know. But I do appreciate you talking about how difficult my job is, because Lord, it's very difficult. I want Barry and Taco to realize this hair works very, very hard.
Well, it's carried you this far is all I know.
Mike, I appreciate this so much. I love you to death, and I'm so glad that we got to you know talk shop a little bit, and you got to dissect a part of the industry that so rarely gets talked about and exposed like this. So thanks for being the Wizard of Oz today. I appreciate it, buddy.
Absolutely, man. Any time. I had fun. Right, you know? I'm around.
All right. Well, next time I'm out west, I'm coming to the porch for the Mai Tai.
Sounds good.
Okay. See you soon.
See you guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks, buddy. Oh, the beautiful tones of Midist, M-I-D-I-S-T. Follow them on Bandcamp. Follow them on Spotify. Give them a listen. They're very good friends of ours, and they were gracious enough to allow us to use their unbelievable work on the What Podcast, Which Bands This Year That Matter. That's Barry Quarter. I'm Brad Steiner. Thanks for sticking with us. That was Mike Daly from Hollywood Records. The thing that I mentioned before the interview was that it's such a hard job. Well, it's not just a very difficult job because you have to produce over and over and over. Yes, I think that Mike says it over and over that he's, you know, just about the quality of work. I think that that's adorable. And I think that there is part of that that's true, but man, you still got to deliver, yep. You know? I mean, there are very few labels in the world that, and again, I know that people hate this, but this is still a label generated and dominated industry. Now, you can make it work without a label, and so many people do, but at some point you need them. And whether it's distribution, whether it's representation, yep. You need them at some point to hit a level that you want to attain. Very few people can do it without them. And like it or not, that's just sort of what the industry is. I think that he can be very open about it wanting to be quality of work, mm-hmm. but I think he still, and doesn't probably want to admit, he's still got to produce hits.
He's got to produce hits, and he's got to have people around him who believe in him. And that's, I think I asked him about it, and he mentioned it a little bit, but that's one of the things that I've seen over the many, many years is an act who has signed, who looks like their, you know, trajectory is skyrocketing, mm-hmm. and then something happens. The A&R guy gets promotion, or the label head moves, or somebody moves, or something changes. It can be small thing. Doesn't have to be a pandemic. And if everybody's not on board, mm-hmm. you know, suddenly it can get derailed. And I loved hearing him talk about sort of who's at the head of the table in the conference room, you know, depends on the meeting. Type of thing. That's a fascinating
also depends
scenario.
On the person too. Yeah. You know, I mean, yeah, there are several. I mean, go around the history of the industry. You know, there are people in the industry that will be the head of the table, and you're sure. not some A&R guys are not going to let anybody else be sure. the head of the table. You know, sure. you know, Clive Davis ain't letting anybody else talk. You know,
well, he's got Clive a track Davis, record. He's got a track right. record to That's back
right.
it up.
That's right.
I'm sort of thinking of this for maybe that podcast listener out there who's in wherever, Iowa, Montana. We all have it. We all have that band that we, you know, were the whether they played our fraternity or they play in our town, who we think this is great. They're the next big thing. And it's, you know, why aren't they making it? Or yeah. they're almost about to make it. And so that's what I'm thinking about with these interviews that we're doing. Hopefully everyone can kind of see what has to happen. You know,
well,
can happen.
I know that I get beat up a lot because of Hootie and the Blowfish, but when you really think about it, the way that artists are being found now, there are no Hootie and the Blowfishes anymore. You know, there are no just bar bands that are hanging out on college campuses that are just magically found and then given a record deal. And within 6 months, their lives are changed. There's just so few of those, right? Right. You have to have, I mean, Alabama Shakes were sort of that way. I mean, she was delivering mail for crying out loud. But, yeah, you know, there's so few of those these days because of TikTok and how, you know, how YouTube and social media has completely changed the paradigm of how people find product.
To your point, Kane Brown, a country artist from the Chattanooga area here, blew up, was doing cover songs on social media, and his numbers were huge and continued, but he couldn't get a meeting for the longest time until they got so big, because the label people were thinking it was a, you know, a TikTok or a social media flash in the pan. Well, he's proven them. he's proven to be a pretty big star in the country music scene. But well, to that, your point,
If you don't have a TikTok and a social media presence right now, you're not even getting a meeting.
You're not even getting a sniff. That's exactly to your point. Yeah. So it's all, you got to have those numbers and then you got to back them up, I guess. So
that shows you how a band is found, how it is nurtured, but you know, it still takes, you can, like Barry says, you can have all of the talent in the world, but if you don't have the hit, and if you don't have the right songs, you're just not going to, you're going to be spinning in place, right? I think of a band, and they're coming to town here, and I love them, and they're good people, but it needs to be said, the band like the Struts, who have an incredible live show. They have, they were in this place a couple of years ago where they're that close. They were almost there, and they just never got there. Yeah. You know, if you remember back in the early aughts, there was a band by Mr. Butch Walker. I love Butch Walker and Marvelous Three. Marvelous Three just couldn't get there. They just couldn't get to that next step. And now Butch Walker is producing, you know, major artists. There, it happens over and over and over, and it has to take that right chemical compound that brings everything together for that right song to hit. And when it does, though, you're made for the rest of your life.
Yeah, an interesting thing that we've learned, I think, Mike seemed very confident in his ability to pick a viable act, say. Mm-hmm. And so did Allie. Remember when we asked her, she was one of the two booking agents that we talked to. Do you know when a band is good, or is it just, you know, basically dumb luck? And she very firmly said, I know when they're good. I find that fascinating. And obviously I would hope she would say that, but,
Well, if
it's interesting, still,
if confidence is your thing, then I've got the guy for you. The quiet confidence of Mr. Troy Hansen, who is the head of rock for Cumulus Broadcasting, is going to take us through next week when these bands start to get their shot. He's the guy they go to. He's the one they call. You know, there are three people in radio, at least rock radio, that make the entire thing work. Three people. You can add a couple more. You know, you can add, and this is radio though, but you can add a couple more on the periphery, like, you know, some satellite radio people, and, you know, Ali Hagendorf from Spotify, who is a major, you know, component in all of this. But when it comes to getting played on the radio, which is still, no matter what you think, the biggest music discovery portal that the country uses, still 90% of people interact with radio on a daily and weekly basis. So, you know, it's still how the industry gets the message out, and it's still how they deliver what eventually will be hits. Troy is one of the three people that you got to go to make it work. And how he then picks the songs that he picks, I will try to take my radio programmer hat off and try and be just a listener with some, you know, general questions, so that you understand exactly how decisions like that get made and who gets played on the radio and who gets the shot over the guy who you thought had it all. Yeah.
How about we let listeners, if they have a question or two, send it to us. And we'll
That'd
ask.
Be great. Yeah. Yeah. Tell it, ask us if you have any, you know, how do you, you know, look, I mean, it's a maddening process, because people have this impression about radio that it just doesn't matter anymore, but it still is the most effective medium to get music discovery out, because it casts such a wide net. So yeah, hit us up at the What Podcast on Twitter. And by the way, the same place that you can register for tickets. If you want to win tickets, we got to do the drawing here in a couple of weeks. If you want to win tickets to Bonnaroo, sold out tickets to Bonnaroo.
That's right.
Wait, the tickets are sold out? No, we're not. We're giving away tickets to a sold out Bonnaroo. There you go. A camping pass. Just hashtag the What Podcast on Instagram or Twitter. And, you know, we'll pick somebody at random here in probably, 10 days, 2 weeks or so, right?
Yeah, we got to give them enough time to get packed. I think it's like 90 days.
Oh, God.
Depending on when you're hearing this. I know.
Oh, man.
I know.
I don't. I'm not ready.
Think about this. We're recording this in early June.
It would be Bonnaroo right now.
When this comes out, it would be Bonnaroo. We would be on the farm.
You know, circling back on some news that happened, you know, in the last couple of days, I think that I want to, you called back to a message on Facebook earlier in the show about a guy who took me to task about Deftones. I want someone to take me to task on liking that ACL lineup. I should be beaten in the street for liking that ACL lineup as much as I do, because it stinks. It stinks. I don't know what I was seeing. The day-to-day got hold of me. I saw the day-to-day breakdown of the ACL lineup, and it is terrible.
Oh, thinned it out?
Yes. You see it, especially when you just do week to week, because so many bands are only doing week one and so many are doing week two.
You see,
there was a day I might have counted two artists that I would see.
You know, I talked about that. That the whole two weekend thing to me is confusing. What you're talking about is what I was alluding to could happen that would ruin it for me. You know, is if I lived there and it didn't matter, great.
But if you're there, it's what you do.
You're gonna pick. Yeah, if you're already there, you're there. Might as well go. But if you had to choose between the two weekends, then it becomes not so good. So
I think that even though we've seen how many lineups come and go, how many Bonnaroos come and go, you know, I'm still a fan, and I still get the wobbly legs when I see something I really like. You know, if I see, like Barry did, the lineup in 2019 might have been, or 2020 might have been terrible, but Barry saw Miley Cyrus and his legs got wobbly, and it didn't matter what the rest of the lineup was for him. It was the best lineup he'd ever seen. When I saw George Strait, my legs got wobbly, and you know, my perspective got a little flawed. The lineup is terrible. It's terrible.
I don't know. Okay, I'll have to look at the day.
Let me ask you this. Oh, this was a conversation we had at dinner in Austin when I went to see the Black Pumas. Is Erykah Badu a headliner?
You asked that the other day.
And you said yes.
At the time, no, I said no, but then asked, you compared to another, and I said yes. So
is Stevie Nicks a headliner?
You know, it's funny because she's going to be down in Shaky Knees, right?
Shaky Knees.
Yeah. To me, she is, if you're going to go legacy act, for sure. And it came up on some social media for a couple of people like, my God, who, you know what? And the first thing my daughter said is, I would go just to see Stevie Nicks.
That's what every 30 to 45 year old woman's going to say.
So, yeah. You know, that's why I said last show, I don't get caught up in it nearly as much as you do, because I get it. That it's,
you know, where the audience is.
As I've said, if they have your favorite person on there, it's the buying up best lineup ever. Yeah. If they're not, it's the worst. So, you think, I mean, I don't.
Rufus Du Sol, is that a headliner?
I don't have an opinion one way or the other.
The answer is no.
Yeah. No. So no.
It is a big no.
Yeah.
It is, and that would be fine. Now, look, I don't need headliners to make a festival go round, but when I look at the rest of the lineup, it just doesn't do anything. Yeah. There is nothing interesting. Now, again, I do like the fact that they did the Tanya Tucker kind of stuff. That kind of, I love that. But then you get to a lineup that is hot trash from the moment you see it. And God love them. I hate to say this because they're fine people, but man, the Music Midtown lineup might be one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. It is a absolute pop culture trying too hard train wreck. They are trying so hard to make that. Look, I don't know if it is like you asked a couple of weeks back, just who you get and what you're stuck with.
Thank you. That's what I was getting.
Maybe that's it. But this feels purposeful.
Late fall, maybe November, maybe October, after it's sort of shaken out, maybe we have Allie and John back on, and even Troy and whoever else you can think of, and just say, how did it go? You know, was this a case of oversaturation? And because as we predicted months and months ago, October and September, September, October, we're going to be packed. and there's only so much to go around.
Well, Miley's gone. She's getting past. Miley's getting on every festival lineup in the country. Yeah. Which, by the way, and that's, you know, I meant to bring this up. I almost feel as though Miley has become Outkast 2.0. There was, I cannot remember when we had that conversation with the guys at Book Bonnaroo. They did I ask them about Outkast and the fact that Outkast played every festival that year on their last tour ever, except Bonnaroo? I don't remember if I asked them that question, but there's got to be something about Outkast not playing Bonnaroo, yeah. The one festival that they didn't play. Something tells me that's the reason why Bonnaroo didn't want them, because they were playing everywhere else and it would sort of water down their product. Maybe Bonnaroo had Miley Cyrus last year, knowing that she was going to try and do a festival run the next year and didn't want to be a part of it and wanted her first.
Yeah, or maybe, they got her and she was that sort of George Strait, like you know, you got your knees wobbly and then everybody wanted her. I don't know. It's an interesting question how that, who gets what and why and how they go to this one and not that one. And
because if you follow any of the Bonnaroo conversation right now, the biggest question is why Miley?
That's why I say I think probably the time to ask is after it's all settled out and just see how it goes, maybe. But I don't know. I mean, we've talked with Brian and Steven at Bonnaroo about how they put a festival together and it's all about the lanes and all that.
Yeah. I don't know if that matters this year.
My point. Yeah. You can say that and you can intend to do that, but it's, you know, unless you are the 800-pound gorilla, you're not picking and choosing everybody you want. Things have to line up so I don't know. That's what I mean. Like, I think we talked with them. They are the big enough a gorilla that they could start with top of the line and then create the lanes.
Sure.
They may not get everybody they want in that lane, but they get the top of the line and then they create. Whereas a lot of other festivals, they got to spray it, splatter shot it.
That just actually made me think about something we didn't ask them. You know, if they start from the top down or the bottom up, if they started from the top down and they, you know, had Post Malone, Lady Gaga, you know, throw another one in, Flaming Lips. If those, and then you start to create everything downward, right? Mm-hmm. Creating a lane for the Lady Gaga fan, creating an urban lane for the Post Malone, urban pop lane for the Post Malone fan, and then you found a rock lane for the Flaming Lips. If they lose one of their top lines, do they fill that spot in with somebody similar because they have already created a lane for that person, or they just try and get the best headliner they can get? We never asked that before.
Yeah, they get the guy who answers the phone.
Yeah. Yeah. If Flaming Lips drops out, do, you know, they go to Government Mule? Or, you know, some other, you know,
right.
If Lady Gaga drops out, do they go to Pink? You know, right. Do they try and figure out how?
Or if Flaming Lips drop out, do they get Pink and have Lady Gaga and Pink?
Right.
That's your question. Yeah.
Right.
I don't remember if we asked that specifically or not. I think we kind of tried to.
Something tells me they wouldn't do it that way. I mean, something tells me they would try and find something that fit. Something the plan that they had already put together.
Yeah. Well, the other sort of question, and I do know this has happened at other festivals. Let's say it's Pink or Erykah Badu, and you have Erykah Badu and Flaming Lips and Post Malone, but then Flaming Lips drop out, but Lady Gaga is available. Do you not take Lady Gaga because you've already got Pink or Erykah Badu? You know, you take. Yeah, you say yes.
I mean, if the money works.
Yeah,
you if see. The money works, something tells me the money wouldn't work. But yeah, if I mean, I just don't think that you have a spare $2 million sitting around.
Yeah, but you know? Also don't say, "Well, we'll get you next time." You know, you take it.
You don't punt on when Prince is available.
Exactly. Yeah,
we'll see you next year.
Yeah, call us back.
Yeah. So next week, How to Make a Hit Part 2 on the What Podcast? Anything else to get to other than check out Midist on Spotify and Bandcamp. Check out Repeat Repeat, the theme song, which, by the way, they sent me their new single that comes out. Oh, I forgot when it comes out, but oh, Barry, they've got a hit. They've nice. Got a hit. I'm saying this as radio guy. I'm not just as a friend. This is a hit.
I love it.
So if it's not a hit, come back to how to make a hit and dissect what went wrong, because this is exactly what I'm actually. It's a great parallel because they've got a song and I think it's a major hit, but based on what Mike said and what will Troy say, those fundamentals have got to all be working in the same jet stream, or else things are going to cross and it's just never going to work. This song is a hit and hopefully you'll hear it soon enough. I feel like they're releasing it next week. I could be wrong. If not, I'll find out and we'll retweet it at the What Podcast on Twitter. Is it at the What? I always get this wrong. Is it at the What underscore podcast? I can never remember our Twitter handle.
Yeah, it's underscores after the What. Yeah, send us a note so you can win some tickets.
Yeah, do it. Hashtag the What Podcast on Twitter. I'm Brad. That's Barry. We'll talk to you next week on the What Podcast. Love you. Bye.
Consequence Podcast Network.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.